Hello, and welcome to the Screen Composer Studio, a podcast about the musical storytellers behind some of your favorite films, shows, video games, and more. I'm your host, Adrian Ellis. Janelle Bechtold's musical journey started not on the piano playing Mozart, but rather on the organ playing 50 swing and tangos. Again, sidestepping more well-worn paths, she studied music therapy at Laurier and spent years alternately in that profession and as a church organist. These activities were, however, informed by and are now critical to her work as a musical storyteller, work which has now been recognized with an incredible 3 CSA nominations in 2021. In our conversation, Janelle describes her interesting musical upbringing, her work helping people heal using music, how she utilizes her diverse experiences in what she does as a screen composer, the issues and stories that link many of her projects together, the important work she spearheaded to push forward the conversation about women screen composers, and the holistic approach she's taking to evaluate where she wants her journey to take her next. Now, it looks like her relationship with the organ has come full circle as she contemplates stripping the instrument down to recontextualize its sound and her approach to making music. If you like what you hear, please consider giving us a rating on iTunes and sharing the episodes with your friends and followers. It really helps us grow and share the stories of these amazing creators. And now please enjoy as Janelle and I waltz and polka around the fascinating touchstones of her life and career. Janelle, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Forgot for a second what we were doing. Show? Oh, welcome to something. Welcome to your life. Here's a funny question. What do you call someone from Saskatoon?
I think it's a Saskatoonian
or is it Saskatoonian?
I'm from Toontown, but.
Oh, you weren't actually born in Saskatoon. You just, you spent time there. Timtown. Where's
that? Toontown. Saskatoon.
Oh, Toontown. Okay. Yes. Boy, oh boy. You'd think I'd know that. I was actually born in Saskatoon as well. It's Saskatchewanian, right? If you're talking about the province.
Yes.
Yeah, Saskatchewanian. I don't know. Why don't we get something cool like Haligonian, where you just change it all up and no one knows what it is? I think we should petition that and just make it into something. So I actually tried looking this up. It was really funny. The no one gives a straight answer. It's like the core for this is just jokes and inappropriate comebacks and stuff. It's pretty funny. So your background and sort of your upbringing and your musical upbringing is kind of unusual. What did your musical life look like growing up, and talk about sort of the main instrument that you played growing up?
Right. So my musical journey started pretty young. My parents realized very early on that I had definitely an aptitude for music. Some of my first memories include like dancing around the living room. I would be singing to the records and pretending I was on stage. But my mom didn't have a great musical experience when she was growing up. She played the piano, and it was very, your typical lesson with a really strict teacher. And, so they got this small organ. It was big enough that it had a couple beats, a couple sounds, you know, it was the kind that went do, 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 do.
Yeah.
But it was different from the piano in that it had different sounds and different things that you could do with it. And so I studied organ, from about age 5. I took the Yamaha Young Children's Program, which was a lot of ear training and sight reading, learning how to, basically musical skills, learning how music gets fit together and being able to like listen to music and being able to appreciate music, being able to pick out different things. I think it was a really good start. It was kind of very similar to how the Suzuki program starts with a lot of ear training and being able to play before you can read. But the really interesting thing about this program is that I learned using music from all over, different eras, different countries.
Right.
And so my musical background wasn't conventional in that I wasn't learning how to play using classical music.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, I was learning using things like swing music or, Latin tangos, polkas. I talk about that a lot, but it's just how music is put together in different song forms. So another interesting thing about my background with taking these organ lessons was that one of the things we were doing was we were learning how to arrange music.
Oh,
so
wow.
We would never just play the song as it is in the lesson book.
Okay.
Instead, it was we might change up the background accompaniment patterns, or we would add intro, like introductions and endings and fancy bridges. We would add solo sections or harmony so that we were learning how to take a song and mm-hmm. change it and make it more interesting and more unique to us.
Hmm. I mean, I get the sense from you as you're talking about this, you seem to be remembering this with a sense of joy and you're smiling as you're talking about it. And that doesn't seem to line up with a lot of experiences that people share in terms of their early music learning. Usually with RCM, it's again, sort of what you described with your mother and it's, they're recovering from that still. Did you feel that at the time? Like, was that something you looked forward to? Did you really enjoy that experience?
I absolutely loved my lessons growing up. I was lucky to have a series of really wonderful teachers.
Mm.
And I was also in a group lesson, which is also often different.
Yeah. And
I think for me, it was that sort of friendly competition that I think really spurred me forward. It's because not only were we having to learn the pieces, there was always one day where you would then perform them for the group. And as a group, we would critique them.
Oh, wow.
And so we learned how to talk critically about music.
Yeah.
How to be both supportive, but also to how to listen to someone else's performance and sort of figure out what we could take away and put into our own.
Right.
In terms of like how it's being performed or
that's
how to
so
make it better.
What was your experience of taking feedback at that time? Because that's a very young age to, well, I guess it's not because your parents are telling you all sorts of stuff all the time and so are your teachers. But I mean, that's interesting. I've never actually thought about this way that you, as when you're growing up, you're constantly getting feedback. And then I guess you get the sense that you want your own agency and you want to control stuff. Okay. I think I'm sort of formulating a question here, which is, of course, now in our careers, we are, the part of what we do is figuring out how to take feedback and make it useful and also not have it crush us emotionally or get upset too much about what that means for our music. Do you think that was helpful for you? And was it hard to hear feedback about what you'd made at that time? Or was it something you just got used to right away?
It felt really second nature just because they started it so early, playing solos in class. But the great thing was that when it came to then playing in public, we already had those skills, you know, in terms of how to perform,
of
just being comfortable performing in front of others.
Yeah.
And so the combination of feedback and that sort of performance element, it just seemed really second nature because they started it so early.
That's so interesting too, because you've got this sort of repeated exposure of having to perform and sort of getting over those nerves. Whereas like this traditional programs are like, you basically are by yourself, you perform for your teacher, and then suddenly it's like recital time. And now you're going to like, whoa, this is a whole other skill that's not taught. They don't give you really much direction on how to prepare for that. You know, it's a whole separate thing. That's so interesting.
So interestingly enough, it's one of the experiences that I had during organ lessons that encouraged me to become a composer.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So I think I was 9. One of the classes we did was on improvisation. It was how to improvise. And our teacher gave us a couple small exercises. One was we had one note and we were supposed to improvise different rhythms on this one note.
Mm-hmm.
And then we changed it up a bit. We got a couple more notes. But this class was particularly inspiring for me. And I remember going home and thinking, if I could only remember what I played during the improvisation, then I could write a song.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I did. It's really interesting going from that experience, like where all of a sudden it was very freeing, because mm-hmm. instead of having to play what was on the page, I could just make stuff up. And by that point, I knew enough about sort of what sounded good, what kind of like chord progressions were natural and that kind of thing that,
I remember meeting, sort of by happenstance, on a film set, no less, someone who was, and I can't remember their name, unfortunately, but someone who was very interested in figuring out a different way to teach music. And one thing that he said to me that really stuck with me was this idea that when you learn language as a child, you learn to speak first. You don't learn to read. And you don't do those two things at the same time. And you learn to speak by imitating others. You learn to like mouth and vocalize certain very simple sounds from ma, ma, ba, ba, pa, pa, onwards, upper to bigger and bigger words and sentences. And he said, he felt that music should be taught the same way. And what you're describing sort of sounds like that. If I think back on my musical education, which was a little haphazard, I took piano lessons. My parents were both musicians. My mom was a teacher. I mean, it's just always a bad situation when your parents try to put you into something that they're sort of the teachers of too, because you're just like immediately you're resistant to it. So that's part of the problem too. But again, the traditional or some traditional ways of teaching it really make it about the dots on the page. And even to this day, I have a disassociation between those two things. I feel very disconnected between the dots on the page and the music that I make. It still doesn't quite make sense. I mean, I can read music, I can understand it, I can make it, I can write it, and I know how to make it make sense for other musicians, but I don't have a relationship to it in the same way that if I open a book, I can just start reading and I can emote something or make it into a performance. What's your sense of the written music now based on the way that you were taught?
So I had a bit of an interesting journey in that my ear training was so good that I would often come home from class and I'd be like, hey, mom, listen to this great new song I learned. And I would sit down and I'd play it completely by memory.
Right.
All hands and feet together. Yeah. And usually you would go home and you'd learn the right hand and then you'd learn the left hand and then you put it, you know, like you'd put it all together. But I would just sit down and play it. And she's like, don't you need the books? And she's like, and I was like, no, I'm good. But it wasn't until I started learning how to play the flute when we realized that I didn't know how to read music. I just hadn't had to.
Right.
And so that I went through a very, very rigorous sort of training session on, just sight reading every single day, sight reading music I didn't know and couldn't know. But that my mom knew so that she could be right. Like, you're not reading.
Uh-oh.
But for me, I mean, the sheet music is just a tool to tell the musicians and to help guide the musicians to play what it is that as a composer you intend. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't contain everything. It can't. But it has to be enough of a structure in order to be able to express your ideas as a composer. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be the music that we know and love as sheet music with the notes and stuff. I know at university, I studied a composition class. And one of the very first things we learned was that notation can take many different forms.
Right.
One of my first pieces at university was a graph, the amount of music or the amount of sound versus time. And, you know, it was colorful. Other students in that class had written prose. So okay. Again, yeah. Like this is supposed to happen. Then this is supposed to happen. Then I want you to do this with your instrument kind of thing. And it was just really interesting seeing how you can communicate in different ways. And it doesn't always have to be, you know, what as North Americans or sort of Western music, so to speak, what we've come to learn is standard. There's many different ways of communicating.
I love graphic notation and some of the most fun I've ever had is just sitting with a block of manuscript and figuring out some strange things that I wanted, effects that I wanted a choir to do or a string section to do. And just writing it by hand, that was some of the most fun. And just sort of inventing these symbols or looking for symbols, like how do other people do this? What makes sense, you know? And I know that Frank Zappa talked a lot about that. He would say that, you know, the way the music looks on the page is as much a part of my art as it is the actual music that comes out at the end. But, you know, still I'm so impressed. I mean, maybe this is just something that comes, you know, in terms of where energy, you know, where focus goes, where energy flows, that's sort of what you get out of it. somebody like, you know, Seiji Ozawa or someone who can just take a full orchestral score and they can hear in their mind what that sounds like. They can, and even the harmony, that to me is the most amazing thing. I mean, like dynamics and articulations, that sort of makes sense to me. But this idea of like, you can look at a stack of chords and just go, yep, this is this, 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 boom, like that just blows me away. That's not part of my skill set. So when you were, you'd sort of gotten this experience of going, oh, I'm interested in this idea of composition. I'm interested in this idea of capturing my ideas and recording them in some fashion and being able to sort of play with them and improvise. Was the idea of becoming a professional composer ever in the picture? Is that something that you sort of saw people doing and went, oh, that I want to do that?
Well, my interest in film music sort of, I had a spark during a family vacation we took to down to California. We ended up at Universal Studios. And as part of the studio tour, you got to experience a soundstage. Oh, and my cool. sister was like, I can see you doing that. And neat. It was really interesting because it planted the seed. But at the same time, I'm like, I'm a little girl from Saskatchewan. You know, like they don't make movies here. I mean, they kind of do. But yeah, it's not like a really big flourishing industry the same way that it is in Hollywood.
Right.
And so there's just seemed to be such a big disconnect between what I knew in the industry in my mind and just like, how does that journey look? And it took me a long time to figure out, okay, this is something I could do. It wasn't until after university when I was looking for ways to use my composition skills that film music really came to be an option, or that I could see it as being a viable option. I knew at the time I didn't really have an interest in being a concert composer, even though I loved the freedom of expression, mm-hmm. but I wanted to eat. You know, I wasn't going to be this tortured, tormented artist because, you know, to be honest, like I also kind of, you know, wanted to have a lifestyle that where I wasn't struggling, you know, that much. And I couldn't see how it could work as a concert composer.
Yeah.
Good art, I find, like I've been to so many concerts where the new music part of the concert comes up and I'm like, okay, so how is the audience to relate to this piece? I mean, in order to really have a good and moving emotional experience, you need to give the audience something to connect to. Mm-hmm. Once you've got them, you can then take them on that journey. But if you're not connecting to your audience, it doesn't matter where you go, they're not coming.
Right. Yeah, context is so important in those places for sure.
Right. And that's where the idea of writing for screen, it gives it that immediate context, that immediate relatability. Mm-hmm. I mean, you then have some freedom in terms of like the emotional elements in terms of sort of how you guide your audience at that point. But it immediately gives the audience something to connect with, which I think is really, really powerful.
Let's say that the financial aspect of becoming a concert composer was not an obstacle and you saw a clear path to doing it. Do you think that that would have been something you would have done in that case?
I think so.
Hmm.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, for me, I had sort of a similar experience in art school, and I went to post-secondary for visual art, and my problem was more so that I couldn't imagine myself being an artist because I just didn't. Once I thought of an idea fully formed in my head, it was done. I didn't need to produce it. Like it had zero interest for me to go through to make the final thing. And oftentimes too, like this idea, like everyone in school was just waiting to get through the technical part of it so that they could start creating wildly and just do whatever they wanted to do and express themselves. And for me, I was like, I got to that point. I'm like, I don't know what I want to say. For me, it was much more interesting to figure out how to solve problems with other people and go, oh, how do we elevate this? How do we tell a story together? How do we do these things? That was the part that was interesting to me. So I could never imagine myself going out as an artist in any sense. And I really resisted that term even for a long time. People would say, oh, you're a really interesting artist. I'm like, I'm not an artist. What are you talking about? Going back to your post-secondary studies, you didn't end up studying composition.
No.
And no. Why not? And what did you end up studying?
So I ended up studying music therapy. So music therapy is the study of psychology and music and how you can apply music as a therapeutic tool within a clinical setting. And for me, I was always interested in how music can help people. That was sort of another interest of mine, is just the healing aspects of music.
Well, and where did that come from? Sorry to interrupt, but that's really interesting. I have to pull on that thread. What made you think that, or how did you come to the idea that it had healing properties, and what does that mean to you?
So I guess at the time it was because, I mean, like every other kid who goes through high school, like kids that don't necessarily have something that they're drawn to, like art or music or sports or dance, I feel like they get a little lost. And for me, music was such an important part of not only going through my high school experience, but coming out the other side still intact, right? That I knew how powerful and important music was for me. And I had always intended to be a teacher. I was going to be a band teacher. Okay. Because I loved band, and I was very interested in my big love at the time was marching band. And so I was very interested in going down to the States where there are more like high school marching bands. And I wanted to like create fancy drill shows.
Wow.
So completely different, but again, very visual.
Yeah.
Very, it's definitely a group sport.
Yeah.
But yeah, something triggered in me in grade 12, and I was like, I don't love high school. Why would I want to come back even right. as a teacher?
Okay.
And
wow.
So I took 2 years off. Mm-hmm. At the time I was teaching organ lessons, and I was looking for something where I was using music, but it was not performance necessarily. Mm-hmm. Because again, as an organist, my performance options are kind of limited. So I opted to go into music therapy.
Give me an example of how music therapy might work.
Right. A large part of my work as a music therapist was done. I was working in nursing homes. Most of my clients had Alzheimer's or some other issue like multiple sclerosis, people who had gone through strokes and heart attacks and were losing their abilities. And so a lot of my work had to do with kind of like I don't want to call them the worst case scenarios, but people who were having issues connecting in other types of programming. So they weren't really able to do a lot of the group programs or, they might have lost language skills. And so I was working a lot one-on-one with clients. I have this lovely story about this one person. One of the symptoms of Alzheimer's can be pacing and wandering, mm-hmm. which often that means that people will walk and they will walk and they will walk up and down that hallway until they end up either so exhausted that they're at risk for falling or that they tend to lash out and maybe hit other residents or staff. And so I ended up coming every week, and I just started by just walking next to them, trying to engage them in conversation. To learn a little bit about the person and who they are, who they were, sort of being able to sort of see where they were in terms of their cognitive skills, mm-hmm. their motor skills, things like that, basically assess them. And eventually, like I would just bring, I'd bring an instrument and start to like introduce song. And eventually I was able to guide this person to sit down at the end of the hall for like a 20 minute, half hour group session, where they would just come and it would be natural. You know, the nurses would run over with, you know, a sandwich and, you know, glass of nutrition, so that they could eat, because they weren't even sitting to eat at that point. Oh, and, wow. And it was just so interesting to see how then music became just this normal activity. And for that period of time, they were able to relate. We were actually able to, work on all sorts of different things at that point. I know a lot of music therapy, or a lot of my clients that I saw, I would use the music to help them regain a sense of self. You know, right. I had some clients who couldn't tell you what their name was, but as soon as I started a song, they'd be able to finish the line. And then they'd be like, oh, I went to dances every Friday night. Oh, that's where I met my husband, Frank. Oh yeah, we have two kids. And you know, it's like, it just started coming back. And that's so powerful.
That's very powerful. Do you have an idea, or maybe there is an actual study of this in some way, as to why is it that music is so powerful for human beings? I mean, I'm sure there are other examples of animals, you know, non-human animals that have music, but, you know, it's a really big part of every single culture on Earth. And it seems to have this almost magical power, as you just described. What do you attribute that to? How come we've developed this?
Well, I think a large part of that is that music is one of people's first childhood experiences. And so it's stored in the brain in a different way, I think. Generally, people who have Alzheimer's, they tend to lose their skills in the order that they're attained. So often, if English isn't a first language, they will lose English before they lose their original language.
Okay, wow.
But when you say that music is something that is in every culture, it's one of the studies that I read about is so fascinating, that music is learned in exactly the same way in every culture.
Really?
Yes. Is that the very first interval that people learn is the da da.
Oh, wow.
Da 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 da. Yeah, every culture. And then from there, it tends to expand into musical dialects of the region.
Mm-hmm. That's utterly fascinating, because that's the sound that kids naturally make. There's this really interesting, I can't remember where or what exactly you're talking about, but it was talking about language, and specifically the first written languages and how they developed from the most basic sounds that we can make. And the easiest sound you can make, obviously, is just to open your mouth and make that sound. And then if you engage the lips, you go ma or pa. Those are the simple, and those were the first sort of words that were ever written, based on the first things you can say as an infant. It's interesting that sort of has a correlation there, whereas that, to me, that interval sounds like you hear kids sort of like, and then you go, da, da. Oh, what's the next thing you do with that? Inevitably, da, 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 da. You know, it's just like, that just becomes part of a language. That's so interesting. Wow. This all threads together really nicely for me in terms of where you end up as a composer for the screen, because first of all, you're talking about the combination and learning how music and psychology work together. You're talking about placing music in a central part of how we remember things. And to me, that's one of the strongest ways to use music and screen, is to use it as a recall device, or use it as a place marker, right? To say, remember, okay, you're hearing this again. Remember where you heard that the first time, and then connecting to events, or connecting a character arc, or connecting two different ideas that maybe weren't together in the beginning of the film, but now in the third act, suddenly, okay, we've got this confluence of these two ideas. You must find that all of that stuff really has a big effect on how you work now.
Absolutely. I find that Or at least initially, a lot of my work started with French language productions. And not having a really strong French background, I actually relied a lot on my therapy skills. Mm. So one of the things we're taught as a music therapist, or we're trained to do, is looking at nonverbal cues that people give. So everything from how someone speaks, the quality of their voice, the rate of their speaking, and then looking for other subtle cues like, you know, where their eyes crinkle or like the corner of their mouth turns up a little bit, and looking for those signals in terms of what somebody might be thinking or feeling. Mm-hmm. And I often find that sometimes there's those little moments where a character has made a decision and it's going to change the course of the film. And the only way you know is because, you know, of one of these, you know, little eyebrow raise or something.
Yeah, right.
So I do find myself looking for those little micro cues. I'm not sure if everyone else does that or not, but it's one thing that I've noticed that is specifically attributable to my therapy training.
Yeah, you're very fine-tuned to it. Is it also that you understand psychological motivation and why people do things? Because I know for myself, certain experiences I had in my life, knowing that, and in a way what I think a lot of people learn through therapy, psychotherapy, is a similar thing. Why do people do what they do? What's the emotional landscape look like? Is that a part of it as well for you?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. Does it help you move through? I mean, this is another thing, right? Like being able to pick up so much. Okay, let me wind that back. So much of what we do in order to get the work that we end up doing is social. How you connect with people, how you interact in a social networking situation, how you talk to someone on the phone or on a Zoom call or whatever. Are you using these practices as well to understand a language on a deeper level of how you're communicating with someone?
I think probably I am at some level. Yeah, I mean, I do a lot of networking and definitely, you know, one of the things is, you know, how do you create instant rapport with somebody? Mm. Well, sometimes part of that becomes what is it that they're doing with their body that you can, you know, are you meeting them where they are, which is one of the things that as a therapist, we learn to do, whether it's musically or, you know, physically, is meet the client where they are. So if they're having a really bad day, then start there. It's like, start with angry stuff. If they're having a really great day, maybe you start someplace else. But I feel like those skills are very transferable to all sorts of situations.
Yeah, absolutely. I think as a whole, we're sort of seeing that emotional intelligence is a much more important and vital part of, you know, success on any level, whether it's as a person in relationships, communication, and indeed, I think, for your career as well. Although I don't know what I would do. You know, one of the people you always dread meeting in a in-person networking situation, and we're kind of probably all going, well, what is that like? I forget what in-person is. Is the close talker. When you get those people, you're like, okay, I'm not mirroring that because eventually we'll be in an embrace.
Yeah. I personally have a hard time sometimes when networking events are too loud, where they have, you know, the music and there's people yelling at each other and you don't want to lose your voice. I probably am that close talker in that I try and speak into somebody's ear rather than.
Oh, yeah. You do have to do the lean in every once in a while, which seems completely insane now, of course. You'd be like, no, that's too close. You can't do that.
No, I'm really not sure how these things are going to work when we finally go back to like doing these in person.
Now we have to speak through a mask and it's just this. No, this all leads us sort of neatly to where you are and some of the projects you're working on. And I have to say huge congratulations, because not only, you know, were you up for CSAs, you were up for 3 CSAs this year, which is absolutely incredible. So huge congratulations.
Thank you.
And what's kind of interesting too is all the projects, there's this, and again, it's a connection that sort of seems to thread back to all the things that have interested you, is that a lot of the work that you do ends up having a sort of, you know, they're not fluffy stories. These are oftentimes important issues that need to be put into the light. They're social justice issues. They're, you know, otherwise, you know, stories that need to be told. And I think I'd love for you to talk a little bit about Marlene, which was one of your CSA nominations this year for Achievement in Music. And because you were doing something that you'd never done before in probably one of the worst times in human history, in recent memory anyways. So what was the movie about? What was your approach? And talk me through the journey of that whole thing.
Right. So Marlene is essentially the story of Marlene Truscott. She is a woman who spent her entire life fighting for justice for her husband, Stephen Truscott, who was he was accused and charged with the rape and murder of a classmate when he was just 14. And in fact, he was sentenced to death. Mm. But, you know, there were quite a number of advocates working on his behalf. And it was actually his story which turned over Canada's capital punishment laws. So, it was a story that definitely rocked the world, so to speak. But years later, he still wasn't exonerated for this crime that he never committed. And wow. So it was her, the story of this film was her journey to make sure that he saw justice.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah. So the film came about, I was right before the pandemic, I was in Berlin at the Berlinale and the European Film Market. And I met the director and producer. She's also the co-writer of the film, Wendy Hiltoot.
How did that come about? Did you have a connection to her already? Or was that just a lucky meeting?
So that was just a lucky meeting.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, she was looking for a woman specifically to come on board because it was such a female-driven story and such an important story that, yeah, she really wanted to work with a female composer. Mm-hmm. And she was looking for someone that just had the right storytelling sort of sensibilities. And we really hit it off. And so just as we were starting the film, the pandemic and the, you know, first set of lockdowns happened. And initially I had an idea for the film in terms of, you know, it was a very intimate film. And so I was going to use a string quartet, I think. But things just happened in terms of the writing and the story, and the score got a lot bigger than I had initially expected. But at the time, I was like, I don't know if I can record. Like, how am I going to record all these musicians together? And especially since everything was locked down, I wasn't sure. Yeah, what would happen? So mm-hmm. I ended up recording over in Hungary because they had opened before we did.
Right.
In terms of being able to have a number of musicians together. But then to supplement that, I worked with, a guitarist in BC. I worked with a flute player in Newfoundland, as well as a few other people, which it was really kind of cool how it all came together. If we were recording here in Toronto, maybe I wouldn't have had that experience of working with people in different parts of the country.
Right. Yeah. So the forced perspective of how you're doing things sort of created these new opportunities. I think you were saying that this is the first time you were recording with a full orchestra. Is that right?
It was.
What was that like in terms of, you've obviously done the orchestra readings and you've had stuff read by musicians before, but from my experiences, it's almost never not terrifying. You're always standing on the podium or in the recording booth or on Zoom or over, you know, whatever the format is. And you're going, I just hope it sounds like music on the other side. What was that? What was managing that like? And what was the sort of like, how did that, what was that experience like?
It was definitely terrifying. Not the session itself was great. I worked with some really great people to help me get to that point. Mm-hmm. I worked with Philippe Telez in terms of, he really helped me with part preparation and Pro Tools stuff. I also had John Herberman help with a few cues. So having some people, you know, who were working in the background really did help. But there were some things that I probably would do differently next time. Okay. And one of those things was I actually hadn't really thought about how long it might take to edit all the takes once I got them back.
Right.
Yeah. And at that point, I was still writing. So that was definitely not, yeah.
Oh, so you got the score back and you were still writing cues?
Yes.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. Yep. Well, because, so I started working on the film during the rough cut stage, I think.
Okay.
Yeah. So the film actually had some dramatic changes in terms of the editing and the storytelling. That in terms happens. Of even some scenes were moved and flipped around. So yeah, I got my I think I got the final cut of the film. It might have been, I want to say, I'll be generous and say it was 10 days before delivery.
Ooh. Oh my God.
It might've been less than that. I'm not sure. But there were some scenes where I was waiting for the sound design because the sound was going to be really important. And I wanted to make sure that what I was doing and what they were doing was complementary.
Right.
Yeah. So there were a couple scenes that, that I wanted to make sure, to wait till the end, but also to like some parts of the process were just because I couldn't have someone come into the studio and help me. It just took a little bit longer,
right.
But, I was, with this kind of film though, it really needed those live players just to bring that humanity to the performances.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Especially in a lot of like the really, quiet moments.
Yeah, you really mm-hmm. can't tell that. Was it challenging to bring together that part of the score and then the parts that you had to do post the recording?
So I worked with Gary Honus at Cool Music, and he helped me with some of the editing as well as the mix. And so he was really great at taking all the different elements and making them feel like they're cohesive.
Right.
Because I not only did I have the orchestra stuff. But I also, I use like piano, maybe some dulcimers, definitely guitars.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had a lot of synths as well, because there were some more dramatic, thrilling, moments that definitely needed, some more creepy vibes.
when it allows for it and you can do another orchestral session, would you be the type of person that would be in the booth, or would you love to stand on the podium?
Oh gosh. I mean, I would love to eventually stand on the podium, but I think there's a real value to being in the booth and being able to hear what's actually being recorded.
Yeah.
And there's some really great conductors out there that, you know, that's what they do. So
that's what they do. Yeah.
Yeah.
Was your director on the call with you while you were live in Hungary?
No. She was actually working on another project and wasn't able to be with us. But
okay.
I know for some other recordings, I've had the director come and be there in person. And there's something, I think, kind of magical for them just to be able to experience that.
100%, yeah.
And really experience sort of how a score is made. Yeah.
There's nothing like a bunch of bodies in a room making a sound together and especially when that emotion and everything it just adds so much more when it's players. That's unfortunate. Do you have video of it, or were you able to show her anything after the fact?
It all came together so fast. I hadn't really thought.
We're all
about
just trying to figure it out during COVID. I know. It's like, oh, right. I forgot about this thing. Dang. This podcast is brought to you by the Screen Composers Guild of Canada, celebrating its 40th year in 2020. The SCGC is a national association of professional music composers and producers for film, television, and media, whose mission includes promoting the music, status, and rights for film, television, and media composers in Canada. Special thanks to the SOCAN Foundation for financial support. For more information on the SCGC, please visit www.screencomposers.ca and follow us online at Screen Composers. And now, back to our show. So you were speaking about this idea that you met this person in Berlin. She was looking specifically for a female identifying or a woman composer, and that this was a specific story she was trying to tell. And you're very involved in advocacy in that same realm. You're the second vice president of the Screen Composers Guild, and you are involved in a bunch of different initiatives. I wonder if you could speak a little bit about why that became important to you and what some of those things that you're doing are.
So the whole women composer thing, I guess I'll call it a thing. The journey wasn't a fast one to get to the point where I was ready to stand up and say, okay, we need to talk about this. Right. But it was just sort of over the years, like when I very first joined the guild, I remember often I would go to events and I'd be the only woman in the room or the only female composer in the room.
Right.
And I would sometimes see composers join the guild and come and, you know, they'd hang out for a couple of years and then they'd go off. And I think mostly it's a hard industry to gain traction. And so if other areas of your musical career are flourishing, you tend to gravitate towards that, which is, you know, providing, you know, a sustainable income and right. sort of a career.
Yeah.
And I guess I was noticing that for myself as well, like it was hard to gain traction. And I could see that other composers were gaining that traction. Mm-hmm. And I was starting to think about, well, why is it that we're not seeing very many women? And there was a thread that happened in the discuss list at the time on women composers, and all the men were chiming in, oh, there's no such thing as sexism in the industry. but I was
I just don't see it.
Exactly. And then they were like, oh, well, what about you women? Do you feel like there's sexism in the industry? And you're like, well, I don't know if I was passed over for a job because they didn't ask me. Mm-hmm. So how do I know if I was passed over? Right. I just don't know. Yeah. And so a bunch of us got together and we started realizing that there are common experiences for women, and we needed to figure out sort of what the actual situation was. And so we ended up putting together the research report that was released in 2018, mm-hmm. Gender in the Canadian Screen Composer and Industry. And that piece of research has been amazing, an amazing tool for advocacy, because instead of saying, well, you know, I don't really know that many women composers, we can say, well, actually, there are, you know, 15% of the industry is female or female identifying. But when it comes to, you know, publicly funded productions, you know, like only 5% of the jobs are going to women. So there is a discrepancy in terms of who's being hired and who's available for work. Mm-hmm. But the other interesting thing about that study was that it also looked at a lot of the barriers and factors to career progression that might affect women disproportionately. And I think looking at how to change some of those sorts of things has been a really useful tool.
What would you say would be one of the biggest changes that you would like to see in the industry?
It's a hard one. Some of the biggest things that I'd like to see changed are things like, timelines and deadlines and, some of that kind of stuff. But that's not really going to change, like, let's be honest. but I think some of the conversations around how people are hired, and especially when it comes down to like production companies, like I can understand, you know, if a independent filmmaker has found someone who they really love working with, their communication styles, you know, work, their creative vision seems to be mm-hmm. complementary. Like, of course they want to keep working with them. But when it comes down to production companies who are getting these, you know, the government money, it's like they should really look at what their talent pool looks like and where they're drawing that from. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I find is that a lot of times they want to give the jobs to somebody who's already done the job. But that's a challenge, because if you're never given the opportunity to do the job, how are you going to get the job.
Yeah, right.
Right.
Yeah.
And so instead of looking at how credits are transferable, like how many web series do you have to do before you're given like an actual series, right? Yeah. Or like how many short films equal a feature film, or how many feature films equal, you know, like, yeah.
Are you in general hopeful about, do you see things changing? I mean, it's been, you know, 3 years since the study came out. You're now in the, you know, the Women Composers Advisory Council, and we're running several initiatives. And we should mention also that, you know, you're also a big part of the Diversity and Equity Initiative. In general, do you think things are getting better? Do you think that we're moving in a good direction? And are you hopeful for the future that things will change?
I am hopeful, but I'm also cautiously optimistic, if that makes sense.
Absolutely, yeah.
Because I have seen some improvements, but I'm also seeing I'm also seeing like two steps forward, two steps back kind of thing as well, where mm-hmm. Where like there was a recent film from, I think, Gina Davis, which was talking about you know, how one woman will make it through, and then everyone's like, oh, this changes everything.
Yes, right.
And then it's like, oh, well, 20 years later, we're still in the same place.
Yeah.
So are the numbers actually changing? So yeah, I mean, I am very hopeful. I do see a lot of really exciting new talent coming, you know, into the industry. And I just really hope that, you know, that there's space for them.
Right. Trying to find that documentary here. It was, it's actually on Netflix right now, and it's really great. What is it called? This Changes Everything. It actually came out in 2018. Yeah, it's really, really good. It's very interesting, and it gives a great perspective on what the reality is, some of the things, you know, because, I mean, one of the issues, or not issues, one of the things that makes this challenging to talk about, whether it's, you know, the number of women in the industry or if it's diversity in general, is that pretty much everyone's experience is this is a tough gig. Like, it's hard for everyone to find work. We're always concerned about where the next job is coming from. I think a lot of people just sort of enter everything with a scarcity mindset, going, there isn't enough work for everyone, which, you know, I mean, you can make the argument on either side. And then, you know, this other, it sort of slides on the other side towards this sort of idea that that we can talk about meritocracy being something that actually exists, you know, like you got the gig because you're the best, which is in musical terms, crazy. It's all subjective, right? So, you know, that film, I think, is really interesting for everyone to watch, especially the men, because it does give that perspective and it really opens your eyes to a broader sort of look at what's going on and the systemic sort of parts of that. That this isn't just something where people are complaining bitter grapes. No, this has been going on for a really long time. It's a significant issue. For me, I would just like to sort of put out there that I think these changes are ultimately not only going to be good for the people who are, you know, at the heart of those advocacy conversations, but for everybody. I mean, if we have something like blind auditions, that really does put the idea that the person that's best for the job is going to get the job. You know, if you're really just talking about who's the best player, who's the best, like, or who is, we're just judging you on your music now, right? Like, there is no way to sort of see past that. I think that's a good thing for everyone.
Yeah, I actually know some companies who do that.
Mm-hmm. Sony's starting to do that.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. Well, that's amazing. I mean, I you know, I'm sort of involved a little bit on these things, and it's definitely close to my heart. And I think there's lots of work to be done. So anyone that's listening to this that has an interest in it, you know, I'd encourage you to put up your hand and get involved, and get involved with the guild in general. You know, this is you're hearing from two people that have been involved with this organization for a very long time. And my opinion has always been, you get out what you put in, and you put in the hours, but there's also a lot to be gained from it. We have had incredible experiences, and the people that you get to talk to, that was sort of the reason why I wanted to stay involved. Is I'm like, wait, I get to keep having conversations with Amin and John and all these other great people. Like, why wouldn't I want to do that? So yeah, get involved. That's my final word on that.
Absolutely.
I want to jump back to where do I want to jump back to? There's a couple of really interesting things. And it has to do with sort of like where you're at right now and the kinds of things that are sort of occupying your mind. We had a really interesting conversation before the podcast, and that's sort of where you're at right now, which is ironically, you've had this incredible success having 3 CSA nominations. Everyone's talking about your work and it's so great. And what you've actually decided to do now is take a step back and regroup and sort of take a broad look at the landscape of where you're at right now and go, okay, where am I going next? Can you talk a little bit about where you're at and what you're sort of thinking about this point is?
Yeah. So I have decided to take a little step back, but it's because I finally feel like I'm at that point in my career where I'm more in the driver's seat. Like I can kind of steer my career.
Yeah.
And you know, there's some experiences that I maybe I'm looking for or haven't had yet. And so it's about trying to figure out where I want to go and what those experiences look like, whether they're, you know, certain types of stories I want to tell, or if they're certain types of like musical experiences that I'm looking for. But I think in order to do that, if I figure out where I want to go, then I can start to attract those experiences. But one of the things that really interests me right now is just being able to explore and play creatively to be able to not only sort of expand the musical tools that are, you know, at my disposal, but to really be able to like really find that joy in that creative process. Sometimes when you're constantly just like writing for other people, you lose that sense of play a little bit when it's always like, okay, when's the deadline? Like, let's, you know, you're like a little hamster.
a little composing so, hamster.
Yeah. And so to take a step back and kind of look at things from the other side too is kind of interesting. So I've always felt like music isn't necessarily always going to be self-fulfilling all of the time. Or like the same way. I think Rob Carley once told me that, like, he was, you know, when he was teaching and he was writing and he was performing, and he's like, if you have different sort of things that you do, then when one isn't necessarily as satisfying as the other, you can put more energy in that and get more out of that, so that you can sort of balance what you're doing and sort of avoid that burnout factor, I guess.
Yeah.
Which I know is incredibly prevalent in this industry. And so I know, like, back when I was doing music therapy, I was playing music all day, every day, 7 hours a day. But it wasn't music for me, and it wasn't my music. It had nothing to do with my own self-expression. And so during that time, I was actually a painter. Like, I painted every day. I would come home and paint. And that's where I had my creative expression. And so for me, I'm at that point where I'm looking to sort of fall in love with music for myself again. It's kind of coming back to like full circle, back to like more of an interest in whether it's concert music or just creating for the sake of creating.
Right.
So that I can sort of refresh the creative, my creative juices. And I think it's going to make me a better screen composer.
What's so interesting, and what I'm really enjoying about this season is, and I guess it's just the period that we're in, perhaps, as these conversations are bubbling up more and more, but it's what I'm finding is that more people are becoming interested in a more holistic approach to what they're doing, right? They're saying, okay, this industry, well, first of all, and we talked a little bit about this too, there's so many myths. There's so many things that we just believe to be true without questioning them, right? Like, I think some of them that you were saying is like, if you're not where you want to be, it's because you don't want it enough. Or if you work hard enough, good things will come, you know? And sometimes that's just not true. Sometimes there's other things that you have no control over that need to happen in order for something else to happen. Mental health has been a big thing that people have been talking about. Or just not even like, oh, you know, you have to worry about burnout and depression and all these things, but just something like, well, athletes work a certain way, right? You have this idea that you push very hard and then you have rest and recuperation. As artists, I mean, you think when you sort of read about daily habits of people, writers, author, painters, sculptors, musicians, composers, performers back in the day when our lives weren't so filled up with stuff all the time. We had opportunities to explore, to think, to get good inputs, right? To put something back in the tank. And that sort of sounds like what you're doing is refocusing on, well, you're trying to gas up. You're trying to put something back in the tank and also just go, is this the car I want to drive anymore? Like, you know, where is this car going? What kind of a path am I on? And I like this idea that you feel like you're more in control, which is a really great feeling to be able to say, or to start to say no to things that are no longer aligned and to go after those things which you want to do. You mentioned something else that was kind of interesting. You're again with the, as you were with, when you were at the end of your music therapy, you started painting, and now you're getting into playing with stop motion and sort of getting into the storytelling aspect of that.
Yeah, that my interest in stop motion has been around for quite some time. But I often go to the St. John's International Women's Film Festival, and I met a wonderful stop motion artist, Lulu Keating, who does these really interesting, kind of like lo-fi, but really incredible stories. You know, lots of humor, lots of just her storytelling style is quite unique. But it's really, it showed me that, well, I think anyone can do this. And so I started getting into it with an idea of, well, maybe I'll just create some videos to go along with some of the music that I write, you know, just on, you know, on my own time kind of thing. But then the more I get into it, it's like, there's so much to know, like lighting and camera stuff and then like model building. And now I'm into, you know, digging into story, because of course all good art has to have a good story. So it's sort of blossomed into something kind of new and different, but it's given me a real appreciation for the process behind film or behind, you know, creating, in terms of like the other side.
Yeah, absolutely. There's this sort of idea that there, in order to have interest and to be able to pursue something for a long enough time, in order to have the grit and to persist, you need a sort of perfect balance between being challenged and not knowing what the next thing is and being excited enough about what you're learning and getting to the next level that it keeps you going. And, you know, on the other extreme, you know, I think maybe that's part of where you're coming out of. You looked at someone like Michael Jordan at the end of Last Dance in that great Netflix documentary. I mean, he's just like, there's nowhere else for me to go. Like I've won the championship so many times. I'm at the, you know, it's so exhausted just in general. And I feel like I've done everything I can do. This is not interesting to me. So he goes and plays baseball instead, right? And I think that's an interesting thing that you're doing, is sort of pulling back completely from that and going, now I'm in this space where I'm being challenged and it's exciting. And I find that too with like doing the video stuff is sort of the same thing. What are you doing anything in music that is giving you the same kind of bump?
Oh, I have so many ideas of things I want to try.
That's awesome.
I'll be honest. I mean, some of the things that I'm working through is like, okay, do I ever really get to do really super loud and angry music, or, you know, like really, really, really fast stuff, or just, you know, playing with new textures and things. I know, I've spoken with you about this before, how one of the things that I'm super inspired by and kind of want to play around with is how can I use the organ in unconventional ways?
Yeah.
And so one of the things I'm really interested in doing once I have enough space to do it is to actually get a pipe organ, all those big long pipes, and find new ways of playing these pipes and making sounds with them, whether it's, you know, bowing them or using mallets on them, or I'm excited to play around and see what I can do.
That's another great full circle idea, that you're going to go back to the original instrument that you learned growing up and you're going to have a new relationship with it. And what's cool too about it is that it's a very physical, it's very tactile. Like you're going to be disassembling what is an incredibly complex piece of machinery and technology. By the way, are you at all interested in like the history of the organ and how it all, like how it was built? And I mean, it's just one of those things you look at and go, like, especially one of those big concert organs or a church organ, you go, just how does that even work?
Yeah. I mean, well, as part of being an organist, you kind of have to know how it works. I mean, there's different kinds of organs. There's all sorts of different history behind them. There's a lot of physics involved as well in terms of, you know, the sizes of the pipes and how those sound and how they play together.
Yeah. You actually spent some time as a church organist too, in a sort of professional capacity. What's something you sort of think about when you go back to that as a job? Was there anything that sort of sticks out to you as a memory?
I mean, I've had lots of really, really crazy experiences as a church organist. I mean, one of the things is that, I mean, I love that sort of, it's half performance, but it's half therapy in a way as well.
Right.
You know, you're trying to encourage a community of people to use music as an expressive tool, and right. Coming together as a group to sing hymns is one of those experiences that often ends up having you know, some uplift, I think. One of the things I often would love to do is, so it usually goes sermon, and then, you know, I think they collect the offertory. And mm-hmm. which usually that's something like a period where there's music, and it's usually supposed to be reflective, and it would often start with a hymn. And one of the things I would love to do, like I used to love to do, was just to improvise on the hymn with whatever the message of the day was. And oh, wow. Oftentimes I would have people come up to me afterwards and they were like, what was that? That was gorgeous. That was beautiful. You know, it really helped me think about X, Y, or Z.
Oh, neat.
Yeah, that was always a really special thing. Yeah.
Oh, that's such a cool storytelling kind of like a different kind of opportunity I never even thought of, is like telling a story through that. What's the message of the day and what's the theme of the sermon, and then improvising. My God, that sounds like a little bit of a high wire act there.
Well, organists often improvise. That's
right.
It's a huge skill. Yeah, but we also, I mean, playing the organ is very different from being like a concert pianist, in that, you know, a concert pianist might learn what, a handful of pieces that they will play over and over again throughout the season, their concert season. But an organist would have to play, what, five pieces, plus then all the hymns. So 10 plus pieces of music every week. And so we have to be able to sight read.
Right.
We have to be able to like be flexible and think on our feet. Cause I mean, I've been in some church settings where all of a sudden the minister will be like, hey, can we do this one? It's like, wow. That's not in the book. Or it's like, I remember this one time I showed up at a church. They didn't have a hymn book. Instead, they had a saxophone player and a conga player that I was supposed to be playing with.
What a combination.
It's like, okay, yep, okay, let's do this.
Wow, classic producer move. You can do that, right? No problem. Okay, let's go. That's incredible. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, I have to read you a description of something. Terrarium is a 3D puzzle platformer about wanton destruction and adorable gore across a galaxy of community-designed murder gardens. Conquer dangerous alien worlds as a feisty granny with a chip on her shoulder and an army of cute but expendable walking mushrooms. That's just a bunch of words I put together randomly, and it has no meaning whatsoever. Or is it a game that you worked on called Terrarium?
This game was so much fun to work on. Musically, I had to create this music for this weird, wacky environment that was dangerous, but really cute and really fun. It was probably the first time that I've used so many toys.
Oh, cool.
Like there was slide whistle and there was like all sorts of ratchets and shakers and weird things like that. There was theremin. And then like I did some other like really cool things, like, you know, adding lots of distortion to the violins. Just to make them all gritty and yeah.
The character of the granny is really funny and the voice acting is so fantastic. Did you actually have that to work with in terms of the materials that you were sort of keying off of when you were making the music?
No. So it was interesting. So I got involved quite early and the game actually did a bit of a shift in terms of some of the community elements. But Yeah. So when I was working with it, Dolores hadn't really, evolved as much, I think, into like the current game, but we definitely had like the little Moogoos. Oh, they're so cute. And you kind of feel bad when you're like,
yeah,
you're killing them so that they like make things explode, but it's so much fun. Yeah, you just kind of have to get over that whole, like, okay, I'm killing these things. But
yeah. Wait, are you a gamer yourself? Do you play video games pretty often?
I do play. I'm not always the best at certain kinds of games.
Right.
Yeah, I definitely have. I certainly love like a lot of puzzle games and things like that.
Did you play this game often as you were working through iterations of it?
I did play, but mostly it was it was towards the end of the process, because at the beginning there wasn't really anything that worked. No, I don't want to say it like that. It takes a while to get something that's polished,
absolutely,
you know, where there aren't any bugs and that kind of thing. So,
I'm stuck in the wall again. Okay, well, we'll get back to you in a month.
I want
to talk to you about another sort of interesting project in terms of the platform, which is virtual reality, VR. Again, a very important story to be told, and many challenges in terms of the way that it was produced and for you to work on it. And I think VR is very interesting, you know, for us as composers. How does the music work? What are the challenges? What are the opportunities? So could you walk us through that? What's the project and how was it working on it?
Right. So that's the Choice documentary, which is it's a documentary about abortion stories. And basically, the idea behind it was to actually share people's stories, because these are things that are often taboo and not talked about. There's a lot of stigma attached to abortion, mm-hmm. And basically allowing the audience or the viewer into someone's own journey to like how they made their choice, kind of thing. Yeah, so they chose VR because of the really intimate ability behind it. Like, you can really feel like you're sitting there talking to somebody. And the filmmakers, they created a whole new technology involving volumetric capture to be able to capture the interviewee.
Oh, wow.
In a real 3D kind of immersive way.
Okay,
So it looks incredible. And we've been really lucky that we've had some really amazing people come on board. An amazing animation artist from the UK. You know, we have some post sound people who are working at, like, with Skywalker involved, and
amazing.
Some developers down in the US as well. So it's been really incredible. My part as a composer has been interesting, because this is my first VR project, but it's been something that I've been interested in doing for a long time. I could see really early on the applications, particularly for bringing experiences to people who might not be able to experience things. Like, mm-hmm. I was actually thinking about how it would have been perfect to really have developed a whole library of like travel experiences before the pandemic, when nobody could travel. Like, that would have been really cool. But anyways, that's
sidebar. They do those cafe things now, which are really interesting. I don't know if you've seen those on YouTube, where it's just like, here's just a shot of sitting in a cafe for 2 hours.
Yeah.
In case you missed it.
Yeah. From a musical perspective, it's been interesting, because the technology has some challenges in terms of, like, how do you mix for the little tiny speakers in, like, the headset? Yeah. Or do people have to wear headphones over top? And what does that mean for the music? How directional should the music be? Should it actually be tied to an object or a thing? Should it be? Or should it just be sort of static and not move? There's all sorts of different kinds of considerations when writing for VR. I was lucky in that these are documentaries, so they're actually sort of little like set lengths. So unlike a game, which has to be able to loop and really be player driven, there wasn't a lot of looping, which is kind of good because then I can still tell the story from more of a cinematic sort of perspective with like a linear story, even though they're like little bits, right?
Does this involve head tracking so that if I turn my head, the picture, the sound picture changes?
Well, the sound does change based on your head position, but it's more of the sounds in the environment,
right?
versus the sounds, like the music isn't necessarily attached to an object because it doesn't really make sense if it's just supporting the emotion versus coming from like a radio.
Right.
Yeah. They did find that for just general ambient music, it's kind of weird if it moves, like if it's attached to something, if it's not like coming from a source.
Right. It's so interesting because, I'm doing some research into early, music in cinema, which is sort of late 1920s. In terms of the music really becoming a thing that appears in cinema more often as part of a fixed part of the picture. And of course the whole argument in the beginning was, well, we have to show somebody on screen playing the music because otherwise the audience will be confused by where the source of the music is. So they would even have these strange conventions that if you heard a melody, you'd have to have you'd hear an orchestra, but just a single string player would be wandering through the forest behind the lovers that were having a scene just to sort of like establish some sort of context for where it was coming from. So this almost sounds like, we're probably not in such a nascent way, but wrestling kind of with the same things where you do have that considered, like what would be disorienting? What makes sense? When would it make sense for a musical sound to originate from a source? Not necessarily a radio, but something I think about in VR, like you're in this space, you're in this environment. What do you look at? Like, where do you put your focus? How does a storyteller signal to you, oh, you need to look over here right now. This is where the important thing is.
Yeah, I think that would be different if this wasn't a documentary.
Yeah.
Or if it was a different kind of story. I do think that music, it would make sense maybe for it to be a little bit more like positioned music if it was specifically tied to an element or like I think about like in horror where often you play the tension leading up to the thing because you want the audience to know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
I could see with something like that being more directional, like how, like in a video game, you would have music to, the big boss is coming, right? Where you always hear the music before they attack. It's the same kind of thing where it's like, oh, well, if it's coming from over here, from the cat tree, then you kind of want to like, you would then position the music there so somebody turns. Yeah.
I'm sort of having this imagining, a terrifying whatever it is inside a closet, and that's where the string riser is coming from, is from the closet. You're kind of like, why is there a string orchestra inside the closet? And if that would be more or less scary. I think you said you were working from renders in this case, right? So you're not actually auditioning things and working inside a VR headset.
No, I mean, I am able to see sort of once everything comes together, like the team, has been putting out, updates to the builds and stuff so that I can sort of see how it's working and see how it's working with some of the other elements. Like as we add like animation or the sound design, I can see that, which has been really useful.
And you're doing that in VR? Like you have a set for yourself?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. Is that your own set? Like do you do other stuff in VR or is that just for this project?
So I actually borrowed one. Oh, so cool. Yeah. Right. Yeah. I find the weird thing, I actually feel like there needs to be some more improvements made to headsets in general. Right. Uh-huh. they're too heavy. They're too clunky when you have to add like the headphones and like the big thing, especially the ones that where you put your phone in and then they're extra heavy.
Yeah.
So I feel like I can only watch them for short periods of time, but They are so interesting in terms of like the storytelling potential. Yeah. I really want to see this type of storytelling format. Just, I'd like to see it a little bit more mainstream so that the technology can just get better and better.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. When do you think this project might be released, and how will it be released?
So they are starting with some film festivals. And then from there, I'm not exactly sure what's after that. But we do have some exciting news coming up. So I would say to watch the socials for that.
All right. And speaking of which, actually, this is a perfect segue into where can people follow you on the social medias?
Right. So my handle's the same on all platforms. It's at Janelle Music.
Yeah, good for you.
Yeah.
Not a different handle for each one? Come on.
No.
That's the proper way to do it, I hear. Just confuse people by doing it differently each time. This has been great, Janelle. Do you have any parting words for the audience? Any kind of message you want to get out there, or things you want people to think about, or
interesting tidbit? You know, it's just a message for emerging composers out there. Like, I know it's a hard industry, but it's also one of persistence. That sometimes you just have to. You have to be in it for the long game. You know, it's not going to be instant, immediate success, but, you know, it's about, you know, creating really interesting music. Definitely focus on the music, focus on getting your technology in order. And then, like, it's about relationships. So, yeah, you really want to build those long-lasting relationships.
And that takes time. It all takes time. It takes time to get good. It takes time to meet the people. It takes time for them. Once you've met them, for the project to come together and you actually have something to work on together. Yeah, that's great advice. I think that's probably the fastest way to be miserable in this is to expect things to happen in any case, but certainly quickly. So that's great advice.
Yeah. And then having your own idea of what success looks like.
Beautiful. Yeah. And it sounds like that's something you're clarifying even more for yourself. And I wish you all the best with that. And I'm sure it's going to come out amazing on the other side. And I look forward to, you know, many more wonderful projects coming from you. And this VR doc sounds really, really cool. Thanks so much for taking the time today. This is really cool to hear more about your background and the stories and your very unique perspective on everything.
Well, thanks for having me.
All right. Cheers. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this conversation, please consider showing your support by giving the show a 5-star rating and sharing the episodes with your friends and followers. The Screen Composer Studio is produced by myself, Adrian Ellis. Graphics and post-production assistance by Nick Grimshaw. Special thanks to our managing director, Tanya Dedrick, as well as Charlie Finley, Elizabeth Hannon,